Welcome back to Hashtag Sisters-in-Law with Joyce Vance, Jill Winebanks, and me, Barb McQuaid. Kim's away, but don't worry, she'll be back soon. It was great seeing so many of you last week in New York at the 92nd Street Y. If you missed it, don't worry, we'll have more live shows soon. And don't forget to check out the new t-shirt at our merch store. It's perfect for any season, and we love seeing you wear them out and about. It really is fun to see them out in the wild. Just go to politicon.com/merch. Now let's get on to the show, where this week we will be discussing the immunity brief in the January 6 case, the indictment against New York City Mayor Eric Adams, and charges against Donald Trump's would-be assassin. But first, I just want to catch up with you guys about our trip last week to New York. It was so great to see you live and in person. The 92nd Street Y is a legendary place. I was so honored to be there. And it was just great being with you, having dinner with you, and, you know, being out on the town with all of you.
It was so much fun. You know, it's never long enough when we're together, right? It's like you get, you know, 24 or 48 hours, and I just want to stay with y'all for a week. But we had a fabulous dinner after the show. The production team picked a great restaurant. It was an Italian place called, was it Elio? Is that right? Elio?
Yeah.
Just really delicious food. I had a blast, Jill, and you even brought a friend along.
I did. And I think you all enjoyed my friend Paula. But yeah, I agree with you. Being at the 92nd Street Y is like a dream come true. It's so prestigious. I loved it. But I think for me, it was, I also saw Suffs, the play, which I loved and was depressed by. I saw Law School Friends. That was terrific. But the best thing that happened to me was I had about 1 hour free and I went window shopping on Madison Avenue, which is just glorious. And I'm walking along looking in windows and a policeman stops me and says, "Excuse me, miss." And my first reaction was, "Oh my God, what did I do wrong? I'm not even driving. What could I have possibly done?"
Sign of a guilty mind.
It absolutely was. There's no question. And he looks at me and he says, "I just wanted to tell you that I was at your show last night and it was terrific."
Oh, that's great.
That was just the best.
Wow.
And I'm so dumb, I didn't even take a selfie of us. So, Mr. Policeman, if you're listening, I'm so sorry. Next time I'm in New York, I want your picture.
The sisters are friends of law enforcement.
You know, I have something along those lines too, because after the show, this wonderful woman who was in the front row gave me this great coffee mug with chickens on it that I've been using all week. And she gave me a card with her name, and somehow that got lost in the shuffle. So I'm hoping if you're out there, if you'll please just tweet at me on Twitter or send us something. What's our email address? Is it sisters@politicon.com?
Sisters-in-law at politicon.com.
Get in touch with me so I can thank you properly. So, important to timestamp before we start our conversation about the special counsel's immunity brief, because it's now Friday, September 27th at 3:30 p.m. in East Coast time, and I bet my sisters, like me, waited all day yesterday, Thursday, for Jack Smith's opening brief on presidential immunity in the District of Columbia prosecution of Donald Trump. This is Smith's attempt to convince the court he still has a case to try after the Supreme Court's presidential immunity ruling. And that brief never came. It was due last night. Smith is not the kind of guy who misses deadlines. So Barb, what happened? I mean, it's still not there. There was reporting it was filed, but nothing has been made public. Although we do, I see, have a new order from Judge Chutkan.
Yes, it was filed under seal. And, you know, this really was pursuant to Judge Chutkan's order, but I didn't think, most of us at least, didn't appreciate that that meant all of it would be filed under seal. She had said that to the extent his opening brief, which recall what this is all about, right? The Supreme Court had said Judge Chutkan needs to do fact-finding about each and every allegation in the indictment and any additional evidence that the prosecution plans to use following its immunity decision to make sure that it doesn't include any official acts or even evidence of official acts. And so in order to do that, she has directed the Justice Department, Jack Smith, the special counsel, to submit a brief with his outlining his evidence. But she said anything that's sensitive should be filed under seal, at least in the first instance, so that she can review it and then decide whether it ought to be publicly released. And I suppose she's thinking about a lot of things, you know, just about the impact of the evidence on Donald Trump's right to a fair trial. Maybe she's thinking about the impact on the election. Maybe she's thinking about witness safety. Whatever it is, she wanted to review it first. So it turned out, however, that they just filed the whole thing under seal. She included some pretty broad categories, anything about, you know, personally identifiable information, grand jury transcripts, government reports, electronic recordings, witness interviews would all be included as sensitive information. And so it appears that all of it is at least meets that broad definition. So what's going to happen next and in this order is Jack Smith has said he'd like to file an redacted, not sealed version of this with the public. And Judge Chutkan has asked the Trump team to respond by October 1st, which I think is next Tuesday, as to whether they oppose the idea of filing this publicly. And my guess is the answer will be yes. So
that's not a guess, Barb. That's a for sure.
So, you know, Jill, what do you expect we will see if we do see it at some point? I mean, how much of it do you expect will become public? Does Jack Smith have an interest in making the information public, or might he too, like Trump, want to keep some of it sealed? And do you think that they'll reach an agreement, or will the judge end up having to decide what happens here?
Well, I'll take the easy question first. Do I expect them to reach an agreement? No. I would say that there's no chance that they will agree on that. Donald Trump's middle name should be Delay. He will fight everything tooth and nail, as he has been throughout this case, to make sure that the public doesn't see the facts ever. Of course, he doesn't want them seen before the election, which is, of course, already, the voting has already started in some states. My state starts next week, but there's states that have already started. And he doesn't want people to know the truth, because the truth is very bad for him. So he is going to keep on fighting this. Do I think we will see some of this before the election? I do. Judge Chutkan has set, first of all, a pretty strict schedule. She said that Trump only has until Tuesday to file any response to the motion that Jack Smith filed to say that he wanted to file a public redacted version where he takes out the very confidential things. And then apparently his appendix is where the bulk of it is. And Trump has until October 10th to file objections to a redacted version of the appendix. And her history has shown that she acts quickly. So I expect that she will rule quickly enough on this that we could see it. And she pretty much shot down all of his arguments on everything. So I am thinking that we will see a pretty good summary of what the facts are that relate to the superseding indictment and why the things that he still has in the charges are all either completely unofficial acts, personal acts of candidate Trump, or why they are rebuttable official acts, rebuttably immune. And he will establish that they are not subject to immunity in the way that the court said conversations with the attorney general are, even though I think that was a really bad decision with really bad consequences.
Yeah. So Barb, what do you think? What do you expect to see in the part that ultimately gets made public? Do you think that there will be anything? Do you think that there will be a whole bunch? I mean, how do you see this playing out?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I guess if I were setting about to do this task, what I would do is take the four counts in the indictment, and I would list out each and every element of each of the four counts, right? Because that's what you have to prove to a jury at trial. And then I would list out my evidence for each of those elements. So, you know, for example, conspiracy to defraud the United States about, you know, falsely claiming that the election had been stolen. What is the evidence of that? Well, you've probably got public statements by Donald Trump. So those can be listed, right? That won't look, maybe it's a tweet, maybe it's a speech, maybe it's a statement on a television interview or something like that. I think that will show up. But I also imagine it will include things like conversations between Donald Trump and Mike Pence, where he's pressuring him to block certification of the election. And it may be that we get some testimony from Mike Pence that has never been shown publicly before. That is the part that might be considered sensitive information, a witness statement. Maybe it was elicited at the grand jury. It may be that it gets redacted, that, we plan to present the testimony of witness one, and the witness one will say the following, and then that stuff gets redacted. So I think ultimately we'll see a mix of a list of evidence that we've kind of seen before. Maybe it was with the House committee on January 6th on the attack or other things like that, that will be publicly disclosed. And then lots of black bars redacting the parts that remain sensitive about witness testimony and grand jury material.
Can I just add to that? I agree with you completely about that. But the thing I worry about is how he is going to establish that these conversations with Mike Pence, with any of the staff that he had conversations with, any White House staff, were not official conduct. And in part that relies on, because they were about the election and his role as a candidate. And so some of this is really tricky, not just because of being sensitive and therefore redacted, but because it goes to the heart of whether it is immune conduct or not.
Yeah. The other thing that I think is super tricky, Jill, is remember that order also says you can't look at the president's motive.
Yes.
I mean, if you can't look at his motive, that's the one I think that has caused a lot of people to say you've essentially made it impossible to prove a case against a former president about conduct while he was in office. I hope that's not the case, but the inability to look into his motive, it makes it pretty hard because motive, or I guess intent, is an element. That's not quite the same thing as motive. But if you can't consider motive, it might be difficult to prove up intent. And so I think that's going to be a little tricky to see what that looks like.
It is.
Can I make an astonishing prediction here? I'm going to go out on a limb and predict that if Donald Trump loses the election, I don't think that this goes back up on appeal to the Supreme Court before the election is decided, right? There's no chance. If Trump loses, I think we'll see the Supreme Court say, "What's wrong with y'all? You overread our opinion. Of course we meant that any conduct that was, you know, involved in the election and in campaigning isn't immune. How could you silly lawyers and lower courts have ever thought we meant anything else?" I mean, I really do. And I guess this is part of this whole just sort of mood at the moment about the court. You know, I did my other podcast, the Insider Podcast, with Dahlia Lithwick last week, and we talked about the court. And I had thought maybe she would talk me off this ledge about thinking that the court has become just a political actor in many ways. And sadly, she was even more into that than I was. And I really do. I think that their interpretation of their own opinion will depend on the outcome of this election. So call me super cynical, but I would not be surprised. I expect Trump to lose the election. I hope the courts will hold. If they do, and then this case goes back up to them for appeal, you know, 6 months from now when we're sort of back on an even keel, I really do think that they'll say, "Oh, no, you overread our opinion."
Well, then Amy Coney Barrett did too, because remember, even she couldn't go along with the full scope of the limitation of evidence.
I do remember
and
that.
So I do hope she'll be writing that opinion. I hope you're right. I would love to see the Supreme Court not be as political as it obviously is, but even what you're saying makes it really political that they would, "Oh, well, if he loses, then we can be honest and true and go back to what is sensible."
You know, it's like, where is Kim when I need her to be out on the ledge with me? So Jill, before this brief got filed, Trump took a stab at derailing the process the judge had decided on, you know, where Smith got to write this opening brief about immunity. There'd been controversy about who got to go first. And we learned something in Trump's filing about his true intentions here. What did you divine from that earlier brief he filed?
Well, again, his middle name should not be John. It should be Delay. So he should be DDT. Oh, that's a good one, DDT. A poisonous substance. And
that's such a 70s reference, Jill.
I know, sorry. Well, I was just a young person then. We learned that he wants Delay. He doesn't care about anything except keeping this secret for now. And I think Judge Chutkan's opinion is so subtly nasty to him because, she talks about his incoherence and his raising over and over and over again, repetitively, the same issues that she has thrown out multiple times. And in his answer to the motion, he basically only had one sentence that had anything to do with the over-length brief that Smith wanted to file, and the rest of it was addressing issues that were not before the court. So I think we didn't learn anything. We just saw repeated the bad behavior of Donald Trump and his lawyers, which I am at the point where I think they're unconscionable and are sanctionable.
Yeah, you sensed that Judge Chutkan was really running out of patience too, yeah. Right? I mean, her language, it was never inappropriate. It was never not judicial, but she really smacked those arguments away. Even though they weren't in front of her, she actually went to the trouble of pointing out why they were wrong in every regard. So it was done.
She was very nuanced. You're right. I mean, it was, she said that the extra pages are consistent with what SCOTUS ordered us to do, which was to have this very clear, close, fact-finding hearing. She said that he was incoherent. She did say incoherent.
She did say incoherent, yeah.
But it was in a nice sentence. It wasn't just, you are an incoherent mess. No, she made it as a nice,
as nicely as one could say you're incoherent.
Yes, I guess so. It was all appropriate, I would say.
So, Barb, this is sort of, in some ways, a question that's unrelated, but in many ways it ties up. In a different matter, we see more evidence that DOJ is really focused on preventing foreign actors from trying to influence U.S. campaigns, right? That's the theme that exists in the Eric Adams prosecution. There are now new criminal charges in the alleged Iranian hack of the Trump campaign emails. It's hard for me to see all of this and not think about 2016 and mm-hmm. Russia. Is mm-hmm. DOJ trying to send a message here?
I don't know if it's trying to send a message, but I will say that they are becoming much more aggressive in filing criminal charges against foreign actors who are attempting to interfere in our election. As you say, in 2016, we didn't even know about the Russia investigation into connections with the Trump campaign because they were so protective. He talks about how he was the victim of the Justice Department. We knew about the Hillary Clinton investigation, but what we did not know is that the FBI was already investigating connections between Trump and Russia because they kept it very quiet so as not to interfere in any way with the election. I think what we're seeing now is a much more aggressive approach where the Justice Department is filing charges. We've seen charges against Russia in recent weeks. And now this week, as you mentioned, Joyce, this case against Iran, who is charged with hacking into computers to steal emails, including debate prep information from the Trump campaign and J.D. Vance vetting profiles. And then shopping it around to media outlets. It also references, notably enough, that there was also an attempt to hack into the Biden-Harris campaign that was unsuccessful. But, pretty big indictment, charging them with material support to the Iranian Guard, which is a designated terrorist organization, computer hacking, identity fraud, a number of serious charges. The other thing that I think is significant about this is it really helps, I think, to refute the idea that the Justice Department is being weaponized against Donald Trump. Yeah. This is a case that is protecting his interests. A hack against him and charging those people who committed that hack. Thank you.
As a proud Chicagoan who wants Chicago to win every title, there are two this week I'm happy to cede to other cities. One is that no Chicago mayor has ever been indicted. Suburban mayors, yes, governors galore. But the honor of having the first big city mayor to be indicted goes to New York this week. So we're going to talk about the indictment of Mayor Eric Adams, who's facing some pretty tough charges. But first, I have a question for you, Barb, which is about another city title. And this involves baseball, so it's right up your expertise. The Chicago White Sox are likely to win the record for the most losing games in a season.
Yes, yes.
They're wearing bags over their head in the bleachers. But they had a surprise sweep against Los Angeles this week and are now facing your beloved Detroit team for three games in Detroit. So will the White Sox clinch the title for the worst win-loss record ever in your city?
Well, I certainly hope so, Jill, because meanwhile, the Tigers have come from obscurity to be battling for a wild card position, currently tied for third in the wild card race, and they take three. So as long as the Tigers win one of these games this weekend, they will make the playoffs, which is incredible considering how far back they were just in August. They've had an amazing run. They've gone something like 31-11 or something crazy like that. But Jill, I'm sorry to tell you that the White Sox have already tied the record with 120 losses to the 1962 New York Mets. And one more loss would give them the record.
Right.
So I say, let's go for the best. Let your team have the title of most losses in a single season and let the Tigers make the playoffs and everybody will go home happy.
Can I just note that something unprecedented is happening here? Jill Wine Banks is talking about sports.
Love it.
I am. Not only is it shocking I'm talking about sports, but I'm in that sort of undecided category of, do I really want to win the worst title ever? And I sort of do, because what's the point of tying it?
Let's go for worst.
And then next year we can come back into something fantastic. But anyway, okay, so back to Eric Adams. Joyce, let's talk about the charges and the elements of the crimes that he's charged with, because it's pretty dramatic stuff.
It really is. It's a 5-count indictment. There's a wire fraud charge. There's a soliciting campaign donations from foreign nationals charge, actually 2 counts of that. There's a bribery charge. And then there's a conspiracy charge to do each of those things, 1 conspiracy charge. Jill, I think we should say, and something that we've all been talking about is, this may not be everything, right? It's very possible that we'll see more. There was this search of Gracie Mansion the morning that the indictment was announced. So who knows what else is coming. But these charges fit together as a sort of cohesive package, because what's happening here is this scheme involving Turkey where the Adams people are using straw donors to give them illegal campaign donations, and they're getting public matching funds in very large amounts of money. That means stealing from the people of the city of New York who fund that. It's wire fraud because they're using, in essence, computers and phones to execute their scheme. And then there's a bribery charge at the bottom. And that's the one that I think we should focus on a little bit, because the Supreme Court's trajectory for the last 2 decades has been to very strictly narrow the sort of conduct that qualifies for prosecution here. We are about at the point where it has to be a quid pro quo kind of bribe. Everyone will remember the governor of Virginia was successfully prosecuted, and then the Supreme Court reversed that conviction, saying, no, it wasn't official action. He was just being asked to set up meetings. Something similar happened when some of Chris Christie's aides were successfully prosecuted in connection with Bridgegate, and those convictions were reversed. The same thing happened in your state. You mentioned Illinois governors.
Yes.
Yeah. Rod Blagojevich, there was this notion that it was okay for Blagojevich to offer to trade his ability to appoint someone to Barack Obama's newly vacant Illinois Senate seat in exchange for some sort of a promise of a government job. That wasn't seen as misconduct or public corruption. It was seen as the sort of log rolling that goes on in politics. So we've watched the Supreme Court narrow it. That tells me that prosecutors in the Southern District of New York, who are really very good at this. I mean, I assume that this indictment was very carefully fly-specked by some very experienced people. They believe that they can prove that Adams took bribes and in exchange for those bribes committed official acts. So it will be very narrow, right? It has to be bribes, not gratuities.
Yeah, and it has to be something that is given before the official conduct happens, because if it's after, it is a gratuity under right. the court rulings. So Barb, do you want to comment more about some of the evidence and why you think that even the bribery charge might have enough support to be prosecutable and sustainable on appeal?
Yeah, I'll speak to that first, the legal issue. And as Joyce says quite correctly, there has to be a quid pro quo of an official act. And we have seen these cases fall apart, like the McDonald case, the Virginia governor who, you know, held events favorable to somebody who was paying him. And we saw Bridgegate, where they shut down lanes, was not enough in a corruption case. I think this one, though, I would make the argument that it is sufficient here, because one of the things that was the quid pro quo in exchange for all of this lavish travel was directing the fire department to issue a certificate of occupancy for a high-rise building. I think that's an official act. That is not just promoting something. That is a decision. It's either a yes or a no. The building gets certified as safe or not. And even though it was unsafe, the mayor pressured them and they were concerned they would lose their jobs if they did not comply, and they did. So I think that allegation is going to be sufficient for bribery. But I've been wrong before about the Supreme Court, and Joyce is absolutely right that they have definitely cut away at the way that public corruption cases can be charged. But back to the evidence, you know, this is a 57-page indictment. And if you read it, there's a lot, reading the tea leaves here, there are a lot of direct quotes of things that were said, which says to me that they have text messages and email messages, because you don't otherwise directly quote things like that. So direct quotes, that's impressive. It sounds like they have bank records and travel records to corroborate this travel and the receipt of funds. We know there was a search executed at two of his fundraisers, his chief fundraiser and somebody who is a big donor. Search warrants were done there. And so presumably they've got campaign contribution records. And there's also a lot of references to other individuals who are helping him. Like there's reference to the Adams staffer, and there's the Adams liaison. There is the promoter. And so there are all these different people. And in light of the way they're described, I have to believe that at least some of those people are cooperating. Like there's one exchange that's amazing about obstructing the investigation, where they say that an Adams staffer was being questioned by the FBI. She excused herself to use the bathroom, and while she was gone, she deleted all the encrypted messaging apps from her phone that she had used to communicate with Adams. And then somebody said that Adams, when his phone was seized, he claimed that he couldn't remember the password, and so they weren't able to open it. The stuff about the staffer strikes me as the kind of thing that they could know only if the staffer themselves were talking, I think. So it seems to me that they've got evidence in the form of witnesses. I heard Damian Williams, the U.S. attorney in Manhattan yesterday during his press conference, also say, "We plan to hold everyone accountable in this case who's violated the law. And if you haven't talked with us yet, you should turn yourself in before it's too late." So there, again, agreeing with Joyce, where there's been reports of other avenues of investigation in this case, including the schools. The commissioner has said he's going to resign. The police commissioner recently resigned. There is something involving a health commissioner. So there are potentially other schemes here that have not yet been charged. And so something tells me they are continuing to investigate those other strains of potential crimes here. And as Joy said, we may see more before we're done here.
Well, you know, Barb, did you notice that when he was doing the press conference, Damian Williams at the end did something very unusual? Maybe I'm overreading this, but he said there, you know, words to the effect that there would be more coming. Mm-hmm. And I have often said in a press conference, you know, investigation is ongoing. but he was much more definitive about it, which made me think the one thing he would be certain was about to happen was that either they would be superseding the indictment to add additional defendants, or they would be taking guilty pleas from defendants who are going to cooperate with them. And that's, I suspect, what we'll see next.
Mm-hmm. I think we're unanimous on that, that there is going to be more. My favorite piece of evidence, though, was the texting about, well, how much should we charge for this ticket? And the person issuing the ticket said, $1. And the person on the staff said, well, that's ridiculous. No one would believe that. You have to charge more than that. And so they ended up agreeing that he would putatively pay $1,000 for like a $15,000 flight.
Yeah.
And I mean, I just think that it was so, the evidence there is so clearly laid out and so blatant that that more is going to come. But, you know, this raises a really serious issue. He is the sitting mayor. He's obviously going to have to spend some time defending himself. And there has been a lot of talk about whether he should resign, a lot of pressure at his own press conference. There were people in the audience yelling, resign, 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 or whether he can and should be removed either by Governor Hochul, who has the power to do that, or this special review committee that can do that. And then there's this interesting thing about who then becomes the acting mayor. So, Joyce, you want to talk about that?
Well, I think it's really an interesting sort of an issue. You know, Kathy Hochul, who is a Democrat, her husband is a former United States attorney, one of Barb's and my colleagues, and she herself is a lawyer. So I assume she has a pretty sophisticated understanding of how this works. It's a lengthy process that's never been used before, but she technically does have the ability to remove the mayor. And, you know, she suggested that he should take very seriously his situation and think about it over the next couple of days. It almost sounded as though she was suggesting that she might pursue this process. Of course, that would mean that New York City would be in the hands, at least temporarily, of the current advocate who's quite liberal. He's described himself as a democratic socialist. So whether Hochul, who is a moderate, will want to do that, I think, is up in the air. I'm very interested to see how this shakes out.
Barb, anything to add?
Yeah, it's very interesting. You know, when someone is simply accused of a crime, that is not a conviction. They are presumed innocent. And so in some ways, I feel like the people of New York who elected him to this position ought to have their votes fulfilled by his service. On the other hand, these are very serious allegations that are going to occupy a lot of his time. In some ways, if they are going to get the benefit of a mayor of a big city, don't they need his full attention? And I just don't see that they're going to get that from Eric Adams in the next 6 to 9 months before this case goes to trial. And looking at this indictment and knowing what I do about how indictments are obtained in the federal system, the evidence appears very, very strong. And so, you know, this is not just a wild, frivolous allegation against somebody. This is an indictment that's been returned by a grand jury. And so I think that if I were an advisor to Governor Hochul, I would tell her that her duty tells her that the people of New York deserve better and he should be removed.
You know, there's just one other thing. We've already mentioned that the Department of Justice has been accused of weaponization by the Trump administration and by the Republicans in Congress who have had weaponization subcommittees of the judiciary, now known as the Lawfare Subcommittee. But here's another case of DOJ bringing charges against a Democrat. They have brought many cases against Democrats. And so doesn't that sort of put an end to this discussion of, you know, Menendez, the senator, was indicted. The representative from Texas, Cuellar, was indicted. California's Cox, Mayor Gillum from Florida, the most powerful Democrat in Illinois, Michael Madigan, was indicted. So there are a lot of Democrats indicted, and there are charges that Trump took money from Egypt when we're talking about foreign things, and nothing's happened about that. So does that put an end to this weaponization nonsense?
Oh, well, yes,
chill,
absolutely.
Chill. Where have you been?
Does. Oh, yes. I mean, you saw Donald Trump's response, right? He jumped right back in and said, These are bad people who are going after Mayor Adams. It's like, you know, I wonder if we're going to see Adams, who interestingly enough, by the way, is an elector for the state of New York. Will we see him and Donald Trump cozy up to each other as people who are subject to this horrible lawfare by the Justice Department? It sort of boggles the mind, right?
Yeah, I think you are confusing logic with statements, Jill. That does make a lot of sense. You know, in Trump world, I can imagine someone saying, well, that's just to throw you off track. That's what they want you to think. They don't care about those people. They're willing to charge those people, but they're weaponizing against me. No, I mean, you know, those of us who've worked in the Justice Department, the three of us, know that to be able to indict somebody is such a big deal. You need approval throughout the chain of command at the Justice Department. It has to go through a grand jury of real U.S. citizens who review all of the evidence and decide whether there's probable cause to believe a crime has been committed. Then the case goes to court. Defense attorneys get a chance to file motions to dismiss for selective or vindictive prosecution. And then the case goes to trial in front of a jury who has to convict beyond a reasonable doubt unanimously. And so the idea that, you know, this is all being done for politics is just nonsense. But I don't imagine that all of the evidence you have just ticked off, which is a lot, will in any way change the talking points from the Trump campaign. Well, earlier this week, federal prosecutors in the Southern District of Florida returned an indictment against Ryan Routh, the man who attempted to assassinate Donald Trump on his golf course. First, I just have to ask this. Did you guys see which judge this case was assigned to?
Oh, my God. What are the chances on a random draw that Judge Cannon would get this? But I'm willing to bet she sees this case differently, where the victim instead of the defendant is Donald Trump.
It's crazy, right? I mean, what are the odds that she would draw it? But here we are.
Yeah, what are the chances? Well, I guess that's the way it goes in the Southern District of Florida. Jill, can you just tell us what's in this indictment, what's charged, and maybe your views of these charges?
Sure. There are five counts, and one of them is attempted assassination of a presidential candidate, which of course carries a very serious penalty, potential life. The others are possession of a firearm in furtherance of a crime of violence, which would be, of course, the violation of 351, the attempted assassination. Then there would be assaulting a federal officer. There would be a felon in possession, and this is sort of under the same statute, not the same exact subset, as Hunter Biden was charged with, which was his was for a drug user in possession of a firearm and ammunition. And then lastly, having a gun with an obliterated serial number. So you have a bunch of gun law violations, and then you have the which is what he was held under originally without an indictment, but just by complaint. And then they got enough evidence after the arrest to show that it was, in fact, not just possessing a gun randomly, but that it was intended as an instrument of assassination. And the evidence of that was pretty stark.
Yeah. So we know that, Joyce, let me ask you this. Initially, prosecutors filed a complaint, as Jill said, just as to those gun crimes, felon in possession and possession of a gun with an obliterated serial number. And Trump argued that DOJ was going easy on Ralph. And he said he wanted the case handled by Florida state prosecutors instead. What do you make of that claim?
Oh, my God. I love this so much, right? I mean, we all know that this is just Trump playing politics. The feds filed these rather slender gun charges so that they could arrest Routh and keep him in custody from the day that they arrested him. They were investigating everything else. They didn't have enough to charge immediately. Donald Trump certainly knew that or was advised of that by the people around him. But, you know, this is so Donald Trump. Here's my favorite thing about this, though. Trump would be complaining, too, if the state was prosecuting this case, because y'all know This is in the jurisdiction of our good friend and MSNBC colleague, Dave Ehrenberg, who is the local district attorney. Dave was busy working on charges the day that this happened. And I just think it's utterly fascinating because he's been an outspoken proponent of decency and common sense in politics, which is to say that he's been critical of Trump and Trump's conduct. I don't really think Trump would have been happy with this case in Dave's hands either.
Jill, you had some thoughts about the gun charges in this case too. What struck you about those charges?
Well, of course, the first thing that strikes me is that it was a way to hold this person immediately because the guns were quite obvious, and his fingerprints were on the tape attaching the scope to the rifle, so that there was good evidence to hold him and to keep the former president safe from any further attempts. While they investigated whether he was actually planning an assassination, whether he was acting alone or not, and to find the evidence of a letter he had written and stored at a friend's house, and another letter found nearby, the letter at his friend's basically said, this is an assassination attempt. You can't find any better evidence of intent than a letter written in advance saying that he intended to. But I think what I was thinking about the gun charges is that, you know, if we had better gun laws, this felon, and he is a convicted felon, wouldn't have a weapon. And we know it was transported from out of state because one of the letters that the FBI affidavit said was that the state of Florida does not manufacture this type of weapon. And so it had to come from out of state. And so I just think it raises the question again of when are we going to pass better controls on firearms, particularly long guns that are of this dangerous magnitude. And you might think that Republicans looking at the potential killing of their candidate for president might start thinking that there should be some sensible gun safety rules. And we don't have those. And so that disturbs me. But I'm glad that at least there were such laws that he could be held initially to keep the rest of the public safe.
Yeah. Joyce, this idea about Florida charging this case, if Florida state authorities wanted to, could they file charges in this case? And even if they could, would that be wise?
Yeah, I mean, you know, they could, right? We've been involved in situations where there have been two sets of charges, and essentially you do it for insurance, just so that if something goes wrong in the federal case, the state has filed charges in plenty of time. And often what they'll do is there will be an agreement that the federal case will go forward first. The state case will stay on pause while that happens. So, you know, I guess I'm sort of agnostic on that here. I don't think it's necessary because I think the federal charges are particularly strong. They seem to be in front of a judge who will be highly motivated to move the case forward and see that justice is done in this particular situation. And so I just don't know as a practical matter that we'll see charges. I did actually get to talk to Dave as all of this was happening, and he told me he had had a conversation with the feds and he was comfortable that they had better statutes and a better path forward than he did. And that's often the case because a federal prosecution, because of the Speedy Trial Act, can move a lot more quickly, can have a heavier sentence, and also in state courts, defendants often serve much less of their sentence than they do in the federal system when defendants essentially serve all of the sentence. They might get about a week, a year off for good time, but that's about the extent of it. Often in the state, they serve just a small fraction of the sentence and the remainder is suspended. So I think everybody involved clearly felt like federal court was the place to be.
Yeah. And, you know, when I was a federal prosecutor in my district. What we would do when there was a situation where there was overlapping jurisdiction and either the feds or the state could charge the case, we'd get on the phone. We'd call and say, hey, we're looking at this case. Are you looking at it? What makes more sense? Should we stand down? Should we go forward? What is the potential penalty? Sometimes the state wanted to do it because it was grouped with, you know, some co-defendants they wanted to charge. There are all kinds of different factors, and it makes sense to coordinate that effort. And, you know, based on the statements, I mean, it sounds like the local prosecutor you're describing was on board to be cooperative. But, you know, the way Trump was talking about it and Governor DeSantis was talking about it is, you know, the feds want to just give them a slap on the wrist. Let us take it. You can imagine them just stepping all over the case and creating discovery and interview records and all kinds of things that could actually trip up the federal prosecution if they're both doing it at the same time and stepping on each other. So cooperation really is the key to effective law enforcement, and the citizens deserve nothing less. Well, now comes the part of the show that we really enjoy the most, answering your questions. If you have a question for us, please email us at sistersinlaw@politicon.com or tag us on social media using #sistersinlaw. If we don't get to your question during the show, keep an eye on our feeds throughout the week where we'll answer as many of your questions as we can. The first question, we actually have two that I'm going to join together because they're quite similar, comes from Dorothy in Ohio and Debbie in Bend, Oregon. And they're kind of related, wondering about how private citizens can seek criminal charges against Donald Trump and J.D. Vance in Ohio regarding threats to Haitian immigrants. And the other question is about civil liability for the claims against Haitian immigrants. Jill, what do you say about those?
It's such an interesting question. And first of all, there is a law in Ohio that lets private citizens ask the government to file criminal charges. And so that's what's happened. A civil rights organization has asked that charges be filed against the former president and his running mate, J.D. Vance, for the false lies they've told about Haitian immigrants that have caused harm to the Haitian community. And I doubt that the state of Ohio is going to file those charges. But that brings us to the second question, which is from Debbie in Bend, which is I've never been to, but supposed to be an absolutely beautiful place that I do want to go someday. And she asks about the First Amendment and whether that gives freedom to Trump and Vance to keep spreading damaging lies. And I would say the answer is no. I mean, look at the amount of damages that Fox News paid and that another lawsuit has been settled for the false statements about the manufacturers of voting machines. You can't keep lying about people. You do have to prove damages. So if anyone in the Haitian community can show that their business was put out of business, that they suffered damages because of this, then I think they could file a civil case against the two of them for their knowing lies. And I think it's quite clear that even if at their first reference they didn't know it was a lie, they certainly soon learned that there was no truth to these allegations, that there could be, you know, in the same way that poll workers have been able to recover from Rudy Giuliani millions of dollars, I think that this could happen here too. So I think there's probably not going to be criminal charges filed on the request of civilians, but that there could be civil suits filed by the people of the Haitian community.
All right. Our next question comes to us from Lawrence in Massachusetts. Joyce, I'll send this one your way. Will the new doctrine of presidential immunity have any impact on congressional investigations like impeachments?
You know, this is really a great question. I think it's fascinating, and I've thought a lot about what the impact of the Supreme Court's immunity decision on future impeachment proceedings will look like. I mean, I suspect that the initial concern is that, say, a future President Trump would try to argue that he's immune from impeachment too. And of course, I wouldn't put that past him. But I think, in fact, the expanded legal immunity doctrine makes impeachment proceedings more urgent. They're the last remedy left for a miscreant president. And we heard Mitch McConnell say in the aftermath of January 6th that he didn't need to vote for impeachment because Trump could still be prosecuted. And now that that is largely off the table, there is clearly presidential conduct that is not subject to prosecution, that really erodes the justification for not impeaching. So maybe the cowards of the world, like Mitch McConnell, will always find a way out. But I think it's made it that much more difficult for him because the founding fathers created impeachment as the check on the power of the presidency. And it's really the last one standing.
And it doesn't require that you violate a criminal code, that it is just a high crime and misdemeanor, undefined, and it doesn't require that you violate a specific statute of the United States.
Well, and now that it's clear, you know, Mitch McConnell had said there's criminal prosecution available. Now that it's clear that that's not available, maybe that means we breathe new life into impeachment. But I'll believe it when I see it, because it seems to me that senators have been very reluctant to convict members of their own party. Our last question comes to us from Christine, and she asks, have any of you read Ketanji Brown's autobiography? And if so, what did you think of it? Yes, I have. Although I did not read it, I listened to it. And I highly recommend listening to it because it's read by the author and it's absolutely amazing. It's just lovely. One of the things I really like about it is she is an unabashed striver. She talks about striving for personal achievement and for family legacy and for racial legacy, that, you know, her ancestors would be so thrilled to see that all of the work they have undertaken for centuries have led to a seat at the table for an African-American woman on the Supreme Court. And so I loved it. I thought it was just lovely. She comes across as, you know, super smart and hardworking, but also a fallible, normal human, and really, really likable. Nerds everywhere, you will love this book. Thank you for listening to Hashtag Sisters-in-Law with Jill Wine Banks, Joyce Vance, and me, Barb McQuaid. Follow Hashtag Sisters-in-Law on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen, and please give us a 5-star review. It really helps others find the show. And please show some love to this week's sponsors, Aura, Lola V, and HelloFresh. Their links are in the show notes. Please support them because they make this podcast possible. See you next week with another episode, Hashtag Sisters-in-Law.
First of all, what does being put through the ringer mean? Does, you know, anybody even know what a ringer is?
Yeah, like a clothes ringer.
I know, but fashion clothes ringer.
That was like when I was a kid. You weren't even alive when there was a ringer.
Know the phrase. I say that all the time.
Do you really? Okay, yeah. All right. I'll tell you a funny story about it. My sister actually tried putting her hair through the ringer and literally got caught with her scalp against the ringer and couldn't go any further. And I don't remember how my father saved her and unwound her hair from the ringer, but okay.
Was it really your sister, Jill, or is that like asking for a friend?
No, that was really, it was true. My sister also put a bobby pin, if you know what a bobby pin is, into an electric outlet and almost electrocuted herself.
Oh, you're not supposed to do that.
She did all sorts of
that's
silly
funny
things. Anyway.
Kids, please don't try this at home.
Ha 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 ha!